Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A recent study out of the Criminal Justice Policy Program at Harvard Law School finds stark racial disparities in the Massachusetts criminal justice system. Here's how one of the researchers, Felix Owusu, a PhD student in public policy at Harvard, breaks it down.
Black and Latinx people facing drug and weapons charges are more likely to be convicted. They're more likely to be incarcerated than white people facing similar charges, and they do also receive longer sentences.
The study was commissioned by the late Supreme Judicial Court Chief Justice Ralph Gantz, who died this week. Suffolk County District Attorney Rachel Rollins wrote an opinion piece in the Boston Globe in response to the study and joins us on the line now. Welcome back, DA Rollins.
How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
I'm well, thank you.
I am looking forward to speaking with you about the study and its implications, but I do want to start, as we noted, the study was commissioned by Chief Justice Gantz. He passed away earlier this week. What's your reaction to his passing?
We have lost a giant. I mean, he was just such a brilliant and kind man. He was moving so quickly before many of us did. 4 years ago, he asked that this Harvard Law School study happened before many individuals were talking about the racial disparities, well before, you know, I had even thought about running for DA. He was just a champion of these issues. I think it speaks so much about how important cultural competency is with respect to the judiciary, and we will have some incredibly large shoes to fill if they could even be filled now that he's gone.
You know, Governor Charlie Baker is now in a position to have appointed all members of the Supreme Judicial Court. What will you be looking for in his nominee to replace Chief Justice Gantz and for the overall structure of the court? He has two nominations he'll be in a position to make.
Yeah, so that is just unheard of, right? I think the last time that happened, somebody said it was John Hancock, and they weren't joking. And I think it was only five justices on the court at the time. But Governor Baker is in an incredibly unique position where he will have appointed all seven. And we hope that he is going to not only look for exceptionally, bright and capable and able individuals, but individuals with a broad range of life experiences and work experiences. So if we look at our court right now, I think I saw a statistic, it's over 328, I believe, years old now. There have been 10 women on the court since the beginning since its inception. Three Black Americans or individuals have been on that court. Exactly zero Latinx individuals have been appointed to that court. We had, of course, the fabulous Judge Duffley, who was on the court and is a woman of color, an Asian woman, but we don't have a lot of racial and ethnic diversity. We also don't have many criminal defense attorneys. We don't have many individuals that have represented the indigent. And remember, Tiziana, that they are the ones that are in court every day with the prosecutors. I think five of the seven are former prosecutors. Of course, Chief Justice Gantz served with distinction, I believe, at the U.S. Attorney's Office and was the head of the, public integrity division there. But we need to make sure we are looking. And then we have made great decisions in the past with respect to Chief Justice Marshall and Justice Cordy, neither of whom had served as judges prior to being appointed to the Supreme Judicial Court. So the governor has a lot of opportunity here. He, I know, is taking this incredibly seriously. I've had multiple conversations with his chief counsel, Bob Ross, about this, as well as the head of the Judicial Nominating Commission. So I know he's taking this seriously, and I have every faith in the fact that he's gonna try to fill these enormous shoes well with respect to Chief Justice Gantz and also the retirement of Justice Link.
Let's turn now to Chief Justice Gantz's legacy, specifically this study, which, as you pointed out, he commissioned in 2016, 4 years ago. So this study found that Black and Latinx people are convicted and incarcerated at rates higher than their white counterparts, receive disproportionately longer sentences for similar offenses, and that is true even though they make up a minority of the state's population. I think the first thing I want to ask you is, are you surprised by any of those findings?
No, I'm not. And I think that there are many poor people or black and brown individuals who have come in contact with the criminal legal system who are not at all surprised by this information. What I was surprised about was just the complete lack of responsiveness of certain members of law enforcement and the lack of data, the gaping holes we had with respect to data regarding, you know, all of the information that Harvard Law School was looking at.
So let's talk about that, because you co-wrote a piece in the Boston Globe about data and transparency in the criminal justice system in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. Jumping off from the study and expressing some of that dismay, I want to note State Representatives Byron Rushing and Juana Matias were part of that. What data do you think we need that we don't have? Fair. What data do you think we don't have that we need, and how do we get that? I mean, that seems like an important but big lift, D.A. Rollins.
Yeah, so what is great is our legislature has actually done tremendously great work in laying out what we are supposed to do regarding the collection of data. And so there are specific sections that tell us explicitly what we're supposed to be looking at. So, for example, whether or not there is a, you know, we're going to track individuals using a single common identifier so that if Rachel Rollins is going through the criminal legal system, I have one number, whether it is used by the Boston police when they arrest me, the DA's office and CPCS when they defend me or prosecute me, probation, the trial, you know, all of these different players in the system. And then ultimately when I get charged or, you know, found not guilty or whatever the result is, when I get charged, when I go into the Department of Corrections system or the House of Corrections, depending on what I am charged with, is there one single standardized sort of common identifier so that we can find Rachel when we need her? And we've seen, you know, that is not happening.
Is that done in other states? Are there other states that have done that successfully, that level of sort of data tracking?
So we know, for example, that there are several other states, I believe Pennsylvania and other and a few others, that the assistant district attorneys receive all of their documents electronically from their law enforcement partners. Remember that we, as the DA's office, I don't arrest people. When I'm indigent as an individual that's been charged with a crime, it's not the DA's office that is saying, write down all of your financial information to see if you're indigent. There are all these other entities that have all of this information about an individual that comes in contact with the system, that we as the DA's office are out here with our hands outstretched, right, saying, please, please give us this data. We are getting paper records every day and waiting for those things. In Pennsylvania, assistant district attorneys are getting all that information uploaded. They have it immediately, and members of law enforcement are speaking with each other. You know, so for me, I look at this and say, we have other states we can look to. And part of what we said, the three authors of this op-ed, is, you know, this, we are Massachusetts. We are leading the world with respect to, you know, technology and innovation and data and transparency and many other realms. But we are failing, and I include myself in this, are failing when it comes to data and transparency regarding the criminal legal system. And, you know, I do want to make sure that we are clear, though, that there has been a lot of money put into the courts and probation. I believe recently they received hundreds of millions of dollars for their databases, and they aren't sharing information with us.
I want to pick it up there. I actually want to pivot, because we have limited time and there's some other things about the study that I'd like to talk to you about. Controlling for other factors, we know that Black and Latinx people, as the study says, quote, are still sentenced to 31 and 25 days longer than their similarly situated white counterparts. That's after controlling for demographics, criminal history, et cetera. We also learned from the study that charging differences, that the initial charging differences, so how severe the crime you were charged for, had a lot to do with what happened further down the criminal justice pipeline in terms of sentencing outcomes, your ability to enter plea bargaining, your ability to be deferred into something other than the criminal justice process. That is both a policing and a prosecution factor. So what do prosecutors need to do differently, and what do you want to do differently in your office?
You're absolutely right. This is not just the police. And so these are initial charges, depending on how many we charge you with and the type of things we charge you with. The study showed that Black and Latinx individuals are usually charged with superior court level charges, right? Where there's exclusive jurisdiction in superior court, as opposed to a district court where there might be concurrent jurisdiction between a district or municipal court and a superior court, or certain drug and weapon offenses, or even mandatory minimum. So what I have to do is teach my assistant district attorneys, as well as, you know, my counterparts do, about what are the implicit biases that we have internally, right? That we are looking at this defendant and thinking that they should be charged with something more significant than maybe somebody in the exact same situation. And what's fascinating is, even with the regression analysis, you are right. We saw 31 and 25 more days, regarding Black and Latinx individuals. So I think we have to start talking more about race. And what you need to recognize is there are a lot of people that are incredibly uncomfortable discussing race, because they think by having a discussion about race, we are calling you racist. And that is not, in fact, the case. But we are well beyond the place where people's feelings about being hurt, right, because we're talking about race, is in no way going to trump the real and documented harm that Black and Latinx individuals and poor people are experiencing every single day in our criminal legal system.
So what does that look like in your office? What do you do in your office to begin to grapple with the implicit bias behind decision-making, to have these conversations about race, and to counteract criticisms you will undoubtedly get from those who believe that these disparities come from core behaviors and not racism in the system, although that is not what the study finds?
Yes, it's not what the study finds. And, you know, also we have, it goes all back to data, where we can actually track things and show, no, we did a regression analysis and we pulled all of those things out and we still saw this disparity. So what have I done? You know, I'm proud that I'm the first woman that's ever been elected DA in the history of Suffolk County, right? Dating back to 1806 is when our office started, literally. First woman of color in the history of the Commonwealth to ever be elected a district attorney. And I say those things not because it has anything to do with me, but there are certain voices that have never been heard in the seat that I'm sitting in right now. You might hear us as the mother or sister or partner of a potential criminal defendant, but it's a very different chorus coming or voice coming from the seat of a district attorney. And what I've done is I've written a policy memo that I think we took a lot of time on, and we explained and we have trained our staff rigorously regarding that policy memo. And we talk about implicit bias and disparities in race and wealth and how they weave themselves throughout many of our societal systems, and the criminal legal system is one of those. I have personally addressed my staff in a letter that ultimately I did put out to the public, but regarding the murders of George Floyd, Ahmaud Arbery, and Breonna Taylor, which, you know, sparked what I would say is one of the largest sort of civil rights and human rights reactions that we've seen, certainly in my lifetime, regarding injustice. And we've asked for input from people. We've had restorative justice circles. We've had trainings. We just have to continue the conversation. And what we aren't going to allow is people's uncomfort to stop us from doing that.
At the top, when we were talking about the Supreme Judicial Court, you commented that there aren't any criminal defense attorneys on the court, and that might be something to consider. I want to pick up on that thread. I have one last question to ask you, because we're going to lose you in about a minute here. A WBUR investigation recently found that at least three of the 11 Massachusetts DAs keep Brady lists. These are lists of police officers whose past conduct might damage their credibility in court and require disclosures to defense counsel. Your office keeps one of those lists. You've said you plan to make the list of officers public on September 25th, which is a week from Friday. Are you still on track for that? Is that something we should be watching for on the 25th?
You bet. You should. And we have said out loud that we are going to be reaching out to the CPCS and MACDL, so the public, the Anthony Benedetti, the chief counsel there, as well as the Mass Association of Criminal Defense Attorneys, the ACLU, and Lawyers for Civil Rights. We know that there are exceptional members of law enforcement that do an honorable and noble job every day with dignity and compassion and cultural competence. Unfortunately, the media is not showing us those images every day. We are seeing the individuals that are not, you know, that are dishonoring the badge, right? The Derek Chauvins of the world are the ones that are uplifted, unfortunately, or that we are seeing in the media. When
the
we see nine Boston police officers, right, indicted, that makes us lose our credibility in the system. And I mean us. I'm a member of law enforcement now as the DA. So we are holding these individuals accountable. Of course, it was the U.S. attorney and the special agent in charge of the FBI that did, because they were federal charges. But we feel obligated to tell the criminal defense bar about this. Now, of course, they've probably seen the news, but on my letterhead saying, if you have concerns about any of these nine individuals, if they have been involved in criminal cases, we will review any pleading that you present to us that calls to question their potential bias or ability to be truthful, right? So this is information that we are adding into our lead database, but we also want to take an additional step and notify MACDL, CPCS, ACLU, and the Lawyers for Civil Rights. And we are going to be continuing to do that.
Just to clarify for listeners, you're talking about the recent arrest of nine police officers involved in overtime scandal at the Boston Police Department, correct?
Correct. That is what I was speaking
of. And when you release that list, we would love to have you come back on air and talk about it. I hope you'll join us for that.
You bet. I will absolutely
Thanks.
Be on. And I am proud that there are other DAs that are doing this as well.
That is Suffolk County DA Rachel Rollins. Thanks for joining us today.
Okay.